On this week's 51%, we hear from an author of a book about what it will take for a woman to be president.
I think we are moving to a place where it's going to be less about gender, and it is going to be more about, you know, who's the right person for the job.
And teaching kids about preventing sexual violence goes the texting route in a rural county. Plus, a teen tells about the travails of junior year. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Katy Perry roared on behalf of Hillary Clinton at an Iowa campaign rally in October. And while Perry wants the former Secretary of State to become the country's first woman president, Marianne Schnall is reflecting upon her book, What Will It Take to Make a Woman President? Conversations about Women, Leadership, and Power. The book features her interviews with a number of well-known politicians, public officials, thought leaders, artists, and activists, in an attempt to discover the obstacles that have held women back and what needs to change to elect a woman into the White House. The book was published in 2013, 5 years after Hillary Clinton lost the Democratic presidential primary to Barack Obama, yet 2 years before she announced her 2016 presidential campaign. I spoke with Schnall about revisiting her book and the changes that have occurred since, in light of Hillary Clinton's campaign.
Well, obviously that is one of the biggest developments to have occurred, is that we not only have one woman running for president, we have two women running for president. In fact, we have three women running for president, because in addition to Hillary Clinton and Carly Fiorina, Jill Stein is also running as a member of the Green Party. So that's a pretty big development, because when I first had written the book, at that time, there were no women running for president. So I would say three is definitely progress. And so I think it's been really an exciting time to talk about this topic, just because, you know, when I first did the book, obviously Hillary's name came up a lot because of her recent run for the presidency. And now to have Carly Fiorina and Hillary Clinton both running is just, it just makes it even more exciting to talk about these topics.
Sure. And as you mentioned, Jill Stein, because that adds yet a third party to the mix.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I interviewed her recently. I'm doing a series with the organization Political Parity, where I'm interviewing some of the women who have run for president in the past, because this is her second run. I also interviewed Carol Moseley Brown and Pat Schroeder. So, you know, there's a lot of anticipation and thought about what this would mean for our culture and our country to have a woman president.
Yeah, let's talk about what that would mean. So what will it take? And has that changed in the past couple of years or since the last time, well, when Hillary Clinton was in the primary and even prior?
Well, I think, you know, there certainly has been, I think, some progress since then, although when you look at the statistics, it's hard to see just in terms of women in political office. Those numbers are still so low, you know, less than 20% of Congress, only 20 women senators. We also only have only 5 female governors out of 60. So the numbers are really so far from parity. That said, I know that when I had interviewed Gloria Steinem back in, I guess, 2011, she had said to me that she thought that it was too soon for a woman to become president, even though she had supported Hillary, whereas when I interviewed her for the book, she was much more optimistic that we were more ready. And I think that's a testament to having more high-profile women in leadership, including, you know, Hillary, who not only showed that she could take the rough and tumble of her presidential run and also be a successful Secretary of State, but I just think across the board there's a lot more awareness and high-profile women leaders that we're seeing. So I think all of that helps.
Does the presidency of Barack Obama hurt Hillary Clinton?
You know, it's really hard to say. And I think, you know, first of all, I want to just also speak about both of these, you know, president and potential presidents as symbols. Because one of the things that, regardless of how you know, what you think of how Barack Obama handled his presidency and the prospect of someone like Hillary Clinton or Carly Fiorina becoming president, it is still such a positive thing to celebrate that we have different faces up there. And having our first African-American president helps to pave the way for having our first female president. That was, you know, one thing that when I spoke to Maya Angelou, she really accentuated. And I think that I always try to frame this issue of having a woman president as, and having more women leaders as an issue of democracy and of diversity. So I just want to say that regardless of how these presidents do, it is still so important to see those different faces up there that represent the electorate. That said, you know, it's so hard to say. I think she is right now sort of trying to sort of distinguish herself from President Obama. I think that he was really sort of stalemated because of what happened with, you know, the Republicans and a lot of the sort of just gridlock that there is in Washington generally. And what I would say to that is one of the things I heard again and again in my interviews that women might bring, and again, I really try to steer away from making generalizations and talking about this topic, but so many of the women in Washington who I talked to said that in general, women tend to bring consensus-building skills to, you know, their leadership, and that in finding common ground, and of course, the government shutdown was ended by this sort of bipartisan effort of female senators. It was spearheaded by Susan Collins. So that's an example of if we had more women in leadership, and possibly if we had a woman president, that maybe they would bring some of those collaborative consensus-building skills to how they would lead, and that might help in a situation where you have so much partisanship that's holding up, you know, progress being made on so many important issues in this country.
Marianne, are we ready for only a white woman president?
Well, I wish I could say that something to the contrary, but it's possible that, you know, we're not. There are a lot of people who think we're not even ready for a white woman president. I guess, you know, that may remain to be seen. I certainly wish that we had more, you know, diverse women up there and in leadership, even just in, you know, Congress, and just in general. I answer it two ways. One, you know, right now, you know, there is no candidate that to be speaking of. But I think if there was, I'd like to think that we are more ready than we've ever been. And that if the right candidate emerged, that that she would have just as much a chance as a, you know, white female president. But if we're not there, I think that should obviously be the goal. And, you know, I think that we're seeing so much awareness, so much just, you know, hunger in this country for more diversity and much more awareness about the need to sort of change the people that we see up top.
You know, I was thinking about something before speaking with you, and that is, you know, clearly the media at least is making the Democratic side about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And, you know, I was thinking about if Hillary Clinton had some viewpoints of Bernie Sanders, if she were more progressive, I wonder if she would do as well. I wonder if it's her more moderate within the Democratic Party, if it's her more, she's more moderate in that sense, if the public is ready for a super progressive female.
Yeah, no, I think that is very true, and I think I heard that a lot during my interviews, and I actually heard during my interviews for my book that many people said that they thought, this is before Hillary's, you know, candidacy and this current race, that that possibly the first female president might have to be a Republican woman because of the fact of exactly what you're saying, that, you know, it might just be too much a liberal, you know, female Democratic president to be first. But I just think that it's going to be the candidate that sort of best matches, you know, the times. I do think that maybe it is helpful that she is seen as a little bit more moderate. However, I feel like, you know, she still represents so many important progressive issues. And so, you know, and I'm not sure that a candidate that is as progressive as Bernie Sanders would stand a realistic chance. So I think that even if she is sort of presenting herself as a little bit more moderate in regards to how she's running, I think mostly based on her record, we can expect her to represent many of the progressive issues that are important to, you know, at least the Democrats that are supporting her.
And on the subject of too much, the other thing that entered my mind was, you know, we're finally ready, we as, you know, the country to consider a woman for president. Well, we've actually considered a woman before. But what about a woman ticket? Can you even see that?
I would love that. That's been a really fun thing to think about. I mean, I don't know how realistic it is. I think that would just be not only a just huge sign of progress for that to happen, but it would also almost remove gender from the conversation. It would both remove it and highlight it at the same time, because you wouldn't just be able to support a candidate because they were a woman.
What about within the same party, a woman ticket? So a woman president, woman vice president.
I mean, that also would be obviously exciting. I mean, I think we are moving to a place where it's going to be less about gender, and it is going to be more about, you know, who's the right person for the job. And I think that it's been interesting to see this time around that Hillary is definitely, I'm not saying using her gender, but she's referring to it a lot, even in the Democratic debate when Anderson Cooper asked her about, you know, that just implying she was an insider, and she said, I can't think of anything more outsider than being the first woman president. That is something that Hillary didn't accentuate as much the first time she ran. I think we are seeing her make reference to the fact that she, you know, is a woman and how exciting it would be to have our first woman president. And so I think that we can do that, but at the same time, obviously, that is not the only, you know, factor in why you would want to support her or not support her.
Right. I remember that moment in the debate and and her expression when she said it as well. You know, I wanted to know when I think about, you know, I keep obviously thinking of your title and what will it take to make a woman president. I wanted to know if we could go back in the discussion and back to where you were talking on the, you know, on lower levels of elected office, you know, mayors, even council members and getting the numbers up on that level to grow where we do have a pool down the road of more qualified women to choose to run or say, please run for a higher office. How will this help, whether it's a Carly Fiorina or a Hillary Clinton or a Jill Stein? I mean, how does this help the numbers at the lower levels if a woman becomes president?
Well, if you know anything about how my book was inspired, it was inspired by my then 8-year-old daughter after Barack Obama was elected president asking me this question of why haven't we ever had a woman president, which just started, sparked this whole journey of writing this book. And I think that is one really important way that it will inspire more women into leadership is just, as I referenced before, just the symbolic nature of seeing a woman, you know, reach this highest office. That just inspires young girls and women to feel that there are no limits. And so I think that would be a really powerful milestone for us to achieve. And honestly, not just for women that they can envision themselves in these high-level positions, but for men too. I think we are learning. We need men to be able to see women in leadership too. And of course, they are also, you know, voting and supporting candidates as well. So I think just the visual, it would be important. But I think that, you know, just the more that we see women who are showing how you can go into politics and make a difference, the more we can also highlight sort of positive stories of public service. I think right now it can look very dysfunctional in the political world, just between what it takes to run for office, the amount of money that it takes, just kind of the vitriolic atmosphere that you sort of face when you run. And that can be very discouraging. And we hear that a lot in terms of the studies that are done about what is preventing more women from going into political leadership. They see those as huge obstacles. So I think that the more that we sort of see women leaders that are, you know, in politics that are facing running for office with kind of the courage and confidence and stamina that we're seeing in candidates like Hillary Clinton and, you know, Carly Fiorina, I think that is very encouraging to, you know, women that might consider it for themselves. So the hope would be that, you know, as I said, if you had a woman as president, that all these young girls that might be like my daughter who, you know, haven't seen a woman president and can't imagine for themselves that they could ever one day become president, would now see that as a realistic possibility. And I think that, you know, in and of itself is very exciting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What if Hillary Clinton or a Carly Fiorina down the road becomes president? How does this country change?
You know, I think a lot of times people ask me about, you know, with Barack Obama, you know, did we have higher hopes? Of course we did, that having our first African-American president would be a positive for, you know, race relations in our country. And I think that certainly it had the same effect because of the, you know, that I was just talking about before in terms of as being symbolic and for, you know, young African-American, you know, girls and boys to see themselves being able to reach that office as well. But I also think that we've seen that actually it doesn't necessarily translate into any measurable change in the realities in these complicated issues around race and gender. So, I think there are people who would say that there's been a little bit of perhaps more racism that we're aware of right now. So I think that any time you bring these things to the surface is only a good thing. And I think that if Hillary becomes president, first of all, you know, regardless or any candidate, what female candidate becomes president, that will be, as I said, this, you know, symbolic milestone. But how she's treated as president will be interesting as well. And will there be sort of blatant sexism that we'll see? I mean, I think there's been a lot of, you know, racism that we have heard, you know, towards Barack Obama. I think that we will have to wait and see. And I think that there's more response when that does happen. I feel very heartened, even as Hillary Clinton and Carly Fiorina are running, in terms of if there are sexist comments being made, and there are, you know, there have been, there is an immediate response, and it's not a partisan response. You know, when Donald Trump made that comment about Carly Fiorina's face, you know, I saw the response online on, you know, from women and men of both parties speaking out against that. And certainly, you know, when Hillary Clinton is facing sexist comments, there's a definite response. So I think it would be interesting to see whether, you know, this would happen if we had a female president and how people would react to that. But it is a necessary growing pain for our country to sort of see how we would react and certainly monitor how we are responding to having, you know, a woman in that office.
That was Marianne Schnall, author of What Will It Take to Make a Woman President? Conversations about Women, Leadership, and Power. She also is the founder and executive director of the nonprofit website Feminist.com, which recently celebrated its 20th anniversary. People who work with victims of domestic violence think the best way to prevent violence is by teaching youth about healthy relationships. They hope this will prevent a new generation from becoming abusers or victims. One crisis center in rural Missouri is working with kids, teaching them the signs and dangers of teen dating and sexual violence. And they will be delivering the message in kids' native language, texting. Rebecca Smith of Side Effects Public Media reports.
What it would look like to be in an abusive relationship as a teenager.
That's Sunny Roberts. She's teaching sexual and dating violence prevention workshops to 7th, 8th, and 9th graders in Taney County, Missouri, leading them through an exercise that shows how difficult it can be to escape abusive relationships. Roberts herself graduated from a nearby high school.
I used to say to myself, one of these days I'm going to be in a gymnasium full of kids and talking about, you know, sexual violence and preventing this from happening.
This passion stems from her own experiences. She was raped while in high school.
I didn't tell anybody. We didn't talk about it.
It took her years to heal, and not talking about it was part of the problem.
It's so, so important that we begin to talk about this at a young age and encourage them to know that even if they are experiencing these things, they have the ability to overcome them.
Roberts launched in-school classes a year ago as part of her work with the Crisis Center of Taney County to help kids learn about abuse, how to recognize it, and where they can turn if it happens to them. Now, domestic violence is especially bad in this county of 52,000 people. There were 559 reported incidents last year alone. Becky Ramirez is the executive director of the Crisis Center. She wants to connect with young people and
meet them where they are.
So Vermeer, along with Roberts, is rolling out a new tool, a crisis text line for teens, where kids can text the center and ask about anything, relationship issues, help in a crisis, or just the local resources that are available.
If we're talking high school students, if we're talking middle school students, they don't talk anymore. They don't pick up the phone and have phone conversations.
There are some similar national services that have proven how well this method is reaching teens. One, the Crisis Text Line, has exchanged over 8 million text messages since it began in 2013. Brian Pinheiro is the chief program officer of another national service, Love is Respect. He says texting can be a better option in rural areas.
There's not always internet out there, so text messaging is the simplest way to communicate.
He adds that young people aren't any more likely to report abuse than adults, but they seem more willing to enter these conversations about, quote, healthy relationships.
Because that is a level where they can kind of start the conversation, because I don't think a lot of people know what a victim is in domestic violence or dating violence, much less I am the victim.
Vermeer thinks there are benefits to having a local service. Kids would only have to confide in one person, someone local, and that same person could connect them with help right away. Help that's basically in their backyard. So if they are having a problem,
they would have an alternative that they could reach out and receive services for that.
She says they'll tell students about the text line during Robert's classes and advertise around town, rather than expecting kids to search them out and find the service online. Sunny Roberts believes her classes are already making a difference and are helping kids to reach out more. Here are some recent student comments.
I have been sexually abused before. I feel scared because it's been terrible. I feel more comfortable talking about being sexually abused. I will use these resources and the information we have to help a family member.
And she hopes the text line will give kids yet another way to reach out. I'm Rebecca Smith, Side Effects Public Media.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. Junior year in high school carries a reputation of being difficult and stressful. Among academics, extracurricular activities, and athletics, college-bound students are left with little free time in the seemingly never-ending competition to achieve the American dream. Sophia Corey wonders, is it worth it?
Junior year has surpassed being just a grade in high school. It's become a syndrome. Want to hang out? Junior year. Want to catch a movie? Junior year. Everyone says that if I just work hard now, I'll get accepted into a prestigious college later. And hard work at that prestigious college will lead to a desirable job. Hard work at that desirable job will advance my career. And somewhere, sometime, it will all be worth it. I started junior year an optimistic, happy 16-year-old. But with each passing core novel, The Scarlet Letter, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, The Great Gatsby, and Death of a Salesman, my optimism faded. All of these esteemed American authors paint a pitiful picture of the culture, economics, and realities of society. The hypocrisy of the religious, the unlikelihood of humans' ability to change, the death of the American dream, and the pressures of social construction on one's career choice. None of these themes fill me with hope for my future. A 2015 study by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York found that 44% of recent college graduates were working jobs that did not require a bachelor's degree. If the American dream that promises hard work will result in achievement, social mobility, and a comfortable lifestyle isn't true, then should I be existing on 4 hours of sleep per night? Should I be unavailable to my friends because of the junior year syndrome? And should I bear the type of stress previously reserved for adults? I'm Sophia Corey. Thanks for listening. For more stories like this, go to openorchardproductions.org.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1380.